brought to you by the Computer History Museum.
You're listening to CHM Live Radio. I'm Chanel Lauren, and I produce the museum's live speaker series. Each year, we bring incredible guests to the museum to talk about computing and the transformational effects it's having on our society. We've hosted a wide range of conversations, from geneticists and asteroid miners to technology giants like Elon Musk and Sheryl Sandberg. Today's episode features Tony Fadell. Tony started at Apple as a contractor working on the first iPod. He would go on to lead the hardware development for the first iPhone. He left Apple to start smart thermostat company Nest, which was bought by Google for $3.2 billion in 2014.
What's the next big thing in Silicon Valley?
I think it's reapplying all this technology to other fields. You know, at some point, we've kind of given ourselves all these tools, but now it's reapplying these tools and really disrupting the other fields.
So, how did Tony become interested in technology? What was it like working for Steve Jobs? And what will mobile computing look like in the future? Find out in this conversation between Tony Fadell and museum historian John Markoff. It was recorded in May 2017.
So today we're mostly going to talk about building and designing and building the iPhone, but I wanted to get into it by asking, so Tony, you know, so let's start by talking about how you came to computing. Because I think my sense is that you didn't, I mean, in Silicon Valley, I often run into engineers, and they come from families of engineers. I mean, it's like engineers all the way down, or scientists. Where did you come out of? How did you get into an engineering mindset? And I think it was pretty early.
It was very early. My grandfather started when I was about 3 years old, would take me around, and he would show me how to fix things in the house. So much to my grandmother's chagrin and my mother's chagrin, I was sitting there like changing electrical outlets at 3 and 4 years old, like fixing that or fixing plumbing with him or painting a wall or something. And then as my brother got older, we would do that together with him. So every weekend or evening, he would just go, hey, we're gonna go do this together, we're gonna do that. And so he would take us around and just teach us how to use tools and hammers and saws and power tools. And you know, every time my mother's like, have they lost a finger yet? You know, or whatever. So it was always this, you know, we were always immersed in, he was from a generation from the, you know, the Depression, Great Depression. So he had to do everything himself.
So part of your time you were in Michigan, but a lot of time you moved around too.
I went to 12 schools in 15 years. So it was always, we were always moving back and forth.
Your dad wasn't in the Army.
No, my dad was not in my Army. My dad was in the rag business, in the clothing business.
Yeah.
And so he worked with Levi's as head of sales in different parts of the U.S. all the time. We would move every 2 to 3 years to different places.
So when did you bump into computing for the first time?
I saw it the very earliest days in about 1979. We had just moved back to Detroit from Rochester, New York. And there was a computer class. It was a summer computer class. It was in fourth grade or something. And I was like, we had heard about this thing called the computer. You know, it was in kind of in the popular press. And I was like, I don't know what it was, but I was like, I got to do that. My parents go, they didn't know what it was either. It's like, okay, sure, it was a summer school. And literally we had, it was an IBM 360 mainframe somewhere. And then we had paper terminals. It was just paper terminals and a card reader, bubble card. So we would sit there and we would put in all
so
the...
it was some kind of basic?
And it was basic. And we'd do basic and we would make the stack and we'd do, you know, 10, print, blah, go to, you know, 20, go to 10. Yeah. And, you know, this kind of thing. And you have your stack of cards. And I was instantly hooked, right? And then we'd play Oregon Trail and that was fourth grade, right? And I was like, wow, this is great.
So the Apple II was out in the world, but that was not your first exposure to computing.
No, the very first thing was that paper terminal, and I could like make things and draw things. I was like, this is cool, you know. And then I was like, I gotta have a computer. And after that was, and my grandfather had taught me all about tools and everything, and he didn't know anything about computers at all, but he saw it as a modern day tool. And he's like, you're really into that. And he's like, and I go, and it was like $2,500, right, to get an Apple II back then with a green screen. And he was, and I was like, I need to have it. And it, so he said, look, you go out and work this summer, and I will match whatever you make to help you get the computer. And so by the end of the summer, I was a caddy, and I was carrying bags, you know, golf clubs, working my ass off, carrying two bags of clubs and, you know, multiple rounds a day. And he matched it, and we went to Computer Land in St. Clair Shores, Michigan, and I was, you know, my 48K Mac, or Mac, excuse me, 48K Apple II, yeah. Right? And then brought it home, and it was my life.
You were 12, 11?
I was 11. 11.
Yeah.
11.
It wasn't all gaming at that point. You were not a hardcore gamer?
You know, it was just after Atari, I think. So we had Atari, you know, playing our own. We had a Fairchild system.
Yeah.
Way back when, a Fairchild gaming system.
Yeah.
So I was in it, but it was kind of out of it. And it was really the Apple II. And then I could make my own games and do all kinds of stuff with it.
So, but, and pretty quickly you got to your first startup. How quickly?
So then we moved to Dallas. And in Dallas, I needed to stay in touch with all my friends that I had back in Michigan. So that's when I got a 300 baud modem. And that's when we started phone freaking. And we were hacking, you know, Sprint and MCI were the, like, latest things. And you had codes and all this stuff. So we started hacking the phone system so I could call my friends back in Michigan because it was way too expensive.
So, but not with blue boxes?
No, they weren't blue boxes. It was just we were running computer programs to try to find the codes that
passwords.
Worked with
passwords,
right, yeah. You know, to get in.
So how did that lead to a business?
So the other guy, another guy that I knew, he was running a BBS on his Apple II back in Michigan. So I would log on to the BBS. So I was saying, we were in Dallas for 9th grade and 10th grade. Or no, 10th and 11th grade. And I was like, oh, I'm coming back to Michigan for senior year. Because I went to four different high schools. So I was like, I'm coming back. And he's like, and this guy's like, I'm starting this business. And he was just 1 year older than me, so he had just graduated. I'm starting this business selling Apple II gear. Do you want to join me? And I'm like, absolutely. And it turned out what we were doing was we were buying all these applied engineering cards from, you know, Texas back in the day, which I was in, right, because applied engineering was in Plano, Texas, where I was living. And we were buying it, and then we were writing software to make those Apple II cards, the applied engineering cards, run more efficiently.
So that was assembler at that point? What were you, how
we were doing? We were doing actually Pascal and assembly. Yeah. So we're doing Pascal and assembly and creating software to help you put in the bigger memory boards and do, you know, Apple works.
So what happened to the business? Did you make money?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the business, it was just the two of us, and we bought all the stuff, and then we had Apple Insider Magazine and all those crazy things. And so we would make our own ads and have them printed, and then we had a phone line, right? And people would send in, you know, on a, you know, envelope, they'd send in their orders with their checks, and then we would ship it out with our software and what have you, and we were doing hundreds of thousands of dollars in sales a month.
So what happened to the business when you went to school?
So I continued to program and do stuff from school, and then ultimately it was turning into educational software. So we were going really educational. All the educational schools needed this stuff.
Which you were buying and reselling, or you were writing?
We were buying, reselling, and writing. We were doing all of that stuff and doing all the customer support for it. And so he wanted to continue the business, said, that's fine, but I want to go to some other things. And he ultimately grew up to like 80 people in St. Clair Shores. We were doing millions of dollars in business a month, reselling, and then it got into the Mac and stuff like that.
Were you in college by this time?
I was in college.
You stayed.
So I stayed on for freshman year, because I did the Apple Fests and the Mac Fest, you know, the computing conventions, and we would have a booth and all that stuff, and it was crazy.
Had you become a fanboy by that time?
I had been a fanboy, like, you know, way before I had my first Apple II, and then it was sunk in, right? Okay.
And so you get to college, and what are you going to be?
I knew what I was going to be. I didn't even know I was going to go to college. Actually, I decided that I wasn't going to go to college. I decided we were going to do this business and we were going to continue the startup and, you know, figure out where it was going to go, because I was like, yeah, I wasn't really enamored with it. And then literally 48 hours before I was graduating from high school, the acceptance letter came from U of M. And I was like, okay, why not? And so that's what I did.
And the first
2 weeks of school, I wasn't even there. Okay. Because
you were doing business?
Because I was at Apple Fest in Boston, we were driving out, setting up the things. And then, you know, I told my parents, I'm like, hey, they're like, where are you? I'm like, Boston. They're like, we're paying to send you to college. What the hell? It's the first 2 weeks of school. I wasn't even there. Like, it was just always on the brain.
So, but you were sort of on a double E trajectory right from the start?
So computer engineering from the start. Absolutely. So computer engineering was a hardware major and a CE major. So both, or EE and CS major.
Yeah.
Dual.
And so one of your mentors, was he your most significant mentor, was Elliot Soloway, who's sort of a big
school.
Name. But did you know him as an educator or as a computer guy or?
I knew him as a computer guy. So I took my first class with Elliot Soloway. It was my junior year. And it was make an app. So it was like make an app class. So like just figure out what you want to build, make the pitch, then build the app, and then, you know, demo it at the end of the semester.
So the IBM PC was in the world by this time, the Mac was
IBM was in the world, and actually we did the class project on the PC at that point.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit, I mean, Soloway's an important guy in terms of education and computing.
So Soloway went to Yale, and he was underneath, I can't remember his professor now. But it was all about education and computing, how to get computers into education and to take, you know, pedagogy into the digital world, right? And he started very, very early days of working with high schools and younger kids to try to see how these tools could be used to help them further their education. And he worked on it for decades. He still works on it today. Right, so probably 50 years now he's been in the field.
Yeah.
And he was doing all kinds of fundamental research with his team at University of Michigan, but at the same time he taught the one class, which was this kind of introductory to application programming and kind of what it takes to work as a team to build programs. So we did the, you know, Mythical Man Month. We would read the, you know, Brooks book, Mythical Man Month, and he would do certain things about the software process, not just about the actual, you know, the coding piece.
And while you were an undergraduate, the Mac came out.
The Mac came out when I was in high school.
High school, okay.
It was a wonderful tool for making fake IDs. I'm not kidding. We made fake IDs. It was great because you had a laser writer, right? And you could make, and so I had a business making fake IDs on the laser writer. So it was highly profitable.
But you knew about it as a project. Did you also know about the team? How soon did you learn about the team that had built the Mac? I mean,
look, we all sat and waited for the commercial, the 1984 commercial to come out, right? And I was also like, I already had my Apple II, and then the 2 Plus came, and then the 2E came, and I'm like, I can't afford all these things. It was like driving me nuts, right? And then I'm like, what's this Mac thing, you know? And so the Mac came, and I just couldn't afford yet another Mac. But luckily, our high school in Texas, we had this huge lab of, I can't remember, but they were some kind of crazy PC clone. And then they had like four Macs. Never used the PC clones. We did Pascal on that, but we did that. We did the Mac.
Did you? I mean, but you made it all the way through college. You didn't bail. You didn't like drop out.
Almost bailed.
To do.
And it was thanks to Elliot Soloway. So when Elliot at the end of the class, you know, after that, I said I want to do this stuff, and I showed it to him, and he was like, "This is great." Blah blah. You know, we got whatever grade we got. Then I go, "Look, I got this idea. I want to do this," and it was all about multimedia. Because I had watched where Andy Hertzfeld went to Radius and they were having the Radius cards and all this stuff. And I'm like, send me to Silicon Valley, Elliot. I'm going to learn about multimedia and I'm going to come back and build a multimedia lab for you. And he's like, what? I'm like, yeah, multimedia, because that's what the kids are going to need, because they're going to want graphics and sounds and it's going to be engaging for education and video. And he's like, And that was when the earliest days of QuickTime, right? Yep. And I'm like, because this was 89, I think. And he's like, sure. Okay, whatever. I don't know what this kid wants, but go. So I get on a plane and I come over here and I go meet with Radius and Raster Ops and I go get free cards and like the wheel of dealing and I'm like, okay. And I come back and I build a lab. Okay. And we created a, you know, kind of early computer vision lab with graphics, and we had SGI machines, and we were doing VR in 88. Like we took the Nintendo Power Glove and we were moving stuff around, and I put LEDs on a glove and like with the SGI. So we had this kind of multimedia lab.
Did you know you ultimately wanted to get to the Valley though at that point? At what point did you decide that Silicon Valley was the place to be?
That is a great question. Besides Apple being here and everything else, the thing that sold me, I'm driving around and I'm like, I heard about this thing called fries. And I'm like, and then there was Weird Stuff Warehouse across the
street. Weird Stuff, yeah. And Haltech, was Haltech?
And Haltech. Yeah, yeah. And I'm like, let's go and look at this. And I go in and I'm like, you gotta be kidding me. It was just like a grocery store of chips. And I'm like, there's nothing like this in Michigan. And I'm walking the aisles and it was like a superstore. Then I go across the street and I can get all this other stuff and I can make and mix and match. And I'm like, utopia, I found it. Yeah. And ever since then, it was like, I gotta be here.
So in Isaacson's book on Steve Jobs, he refers to you as a brash entrepreneurial programmer. And I thought, what's that? That's not the way I thought of you. Where did he get that?
Well, I think, you know, I'm an ask for forgiveness instead of permission kind of guy. Like, I'm going to do it, like, make it happen. So when I was at, and there's Mark Perrett right there. Hi, Mark. When I was at General Magic, you know, the very first, like, second month, my boss's boss goes, he's an over-exuberant youth. I don't know what to do with this kid. Like, I just wouldn't follow any rules.
Well, dial back. How did you find out about these guys? These guys were totally stealth. How did you find out about them?
The back of Mac Week magazine. You had to read that religiously. Like, every week it would come, and you would read every single word and learn about every single thing going on in the Mac or in the Apple world through Mac Week magazine, because there was no internet.
So I talked to Mark before we started. He said there were lots of kids like you knocking on the door, as it turns out. How did you get in the door?
I guess I was just incredibly crazy and persistent, because I just, you know, one time I showed up at 8 in the morning on Mountain View in Castro Street when they were there. I'm like, ugh.
You have a college degree at this point, or is this before?
Oh, no, I was just about to get it.
Yeah.
I was just about to get it. But I was knocking on the door, and I was like, and I go in, and I go into Castro Street, and I look around, and there's, like, no one there. And then I'm walking through, and then, like, it was clearly someone had been there all night. Like, there was somebody there, but they had been there all night. And they looked at me like, who is this guy? I'm like, hey, I'm here, and I have my coat on, you know. And they're like, we're not hiring. Leave us alone, kind of a thing. Go away, kid. You know what I mean? And so I was 21 at the time. And so I just kept trying to figure out a way. And then I met a Silicon Valley VC. And I said, hey, I need to go and get into General Magic or Apple or somewhere. But I really want to be in General Magic. He goes, I know some people at Apple in recruiting. Let me hook you up with them.
So Apple. Even though they were not, Apple was...
Well, because there was also Taligent and Kaleida then.
You could have ended up at Kaleida. How would the world
have worked out? Well, I had a job offer from Kaleida.
Okay.
Thank God. Kaleida into the wall. You know?
It would have been a learning experience.
Yeah. Oh, and then ultimately they also said, well, we'll also get you hooked up with an interview at General Magic. And I said, yes.
And so who interviewed you?
Everybody.
Okay. So did you meet Andy at that point
and the team? Andy and Scott Canaster and David Sloot.
They were still in stealth at this point.
Totally in stealth. Yeah. Totally in stealth. So, you know, I walk in and there's a Neo Geo stand-up arcade and I'm like, where am I? And I have a tie and a jacket on. Everyone's like, take that off. You know, and I was like, I was vibrating.
So you get hired. What do they have you do?
Get hired. It wasn't that easy. But the very first thing, I was the lowest guy on the totem pole. Like, I just came in, I said, I'll do anything. Just give me something. And they're like, here, go make all the diagnostics for the new chip that's coming that we're building so that we can know that it works and we can try things for this new chip that was going to power the what became the General Magic Cap device.
But they weren't, at that point, they were building a platform, they were building a system, they weren't really building consumer products.
No, it was a platform company. We had models and we had all this stuff, but it was like, we're going to need the big brands of the world to take what we're doing and move it out.
Yeah. And one of the things that always struck me is that, I don't know at what juncture, but at some point, you sat almost back to back with Andy Rubin as two, and I mean, it's stunning to me because, you know, how many years later, there are sort of two platforms in the world. There's you know, iOS and there's Android.
Android, yeah.
And those sort of the seeds of that were in one place, like 20 feet apart, 10 feet apart.
We were literally right there, like next to each other, pulling pranks on each other, you know, doing all these things. And, you know, if you think about what was done at General Magic, about hardware, software, services, you know, the whole kind of ecosystem that was created. That was a formidable time for all of us who were like 27 and younger. And almost all of our careers were defined by that. And we continued to live by that. And yeah, if you look at the, you know, General Magic PDA, you know, Magic Cap device, it was personal intelligent communicator, sorry, Joanna, the PIC. it was about, we were just too soon. We were 15 years too soon. But we always knew, we saw that vision and it had to come to light and we just kept working on it,
yeah.
Right? Because it was so compelling. It was just, we were just so early.
Would you have guessed that it was going to take 15 years then? How out of sync?
Geez, we thought we were going to rule the world in 94,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
so,
yeah,
you know, so to know that it's going to take another basically 13 years after that,
yeah,
you know?
And so
you
when
would
it,
have never guessed it.
When it fell apart, you were young. This was your sort of first major failure? Or did it feel like failure? What did it feel like?
Oh, it felt like failure.
Yeah.
You know, when you're working, like, you come out here and you're going to go work with your heroes and you're, honest to God, 100 to 120 hours a week living there, eating every meal with this family. We were family, right? And we were so convinced, and the world was convinced. And I was young. I hadn't seen Silicon Valley failure before, you know, like a lot of other people who were older did. So I just believed it, yeah. Right? And you're just like, we're going to make this happen. We're going to will it into the world.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so, yeah, when it hits the wall, there's a, you know, existential crisis of like, what does my life mean?
And when it fell apart, were you pushed? Did people like get pink slips or did you jump?
No, I left.
Yeah.
I left.
So it was bad and things.
Well, we had just gone public. There was all this stuff going on. So, you know, to the outside world, everything was going fine. But on the inside, you could see things were not what we wanted them to be because we had a bold, bold vision. And we were so far ahead. This is where I learned that you could have bold vision, but you have to also track the societal mindset of the time, and you can just take them just so far. You can't take them so far. Like, you know, with the mantra around General Magic, right? You know, sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. And so we were so in the future that everybody thought it was magic, but they didn't know what they needed it for. We couldn't communicate why they needed it. We were like, this is the future. They're like, yeah, good, but I don't need it today, yeah. Right? You didn't solve any problem that we knew they're going to have these problems. They didn't know they had those problems yet,
yeah.
Right? So you have to have this advanced technology, but just ahead of where society is so they can adopt it, and then you leapfrog yourself and pull them forward. But you can't be over here, and then they're like, well, I don't know. Well, you know.
So you leave, and you take this vision that you've sort of come to be part of this team with you to Philips, that also is a little bit of a wrong turn.
Well,
culturally, a Dutch company.
Culturally, yes. Yeah. Culturally, yes. But I give them incredible credit because they were partners at General Magic, right? And so I put together a business plan and a product design, and I said, and I went to the CEO of Philips at the time, and I go, we should be making this. This is what we should do. And I was 25 years old. He's like, sure, go build that. It's like, shit, be careful what you ask for. Like, I was just an individual engineer. No one was reporting to me. I didn't have a team. Now I had to build an engineering team at 25, and, you know, and then we actually built a device and shipped it 2 years later, so.
It got into the market.
It got in the market. We won all kinds of critical awards.
This was a communicator.
Windows PDA.
So yeah. How did it do?
So it was a critical success. We blew everybody in the market of those Windows PDAs at the time. We blew them away.
Yeah.
And so we critically success. But then, so the first thing was making sure you design a product that the is meeting specific needs that the market needs, and designing an attractive package, all that stuff. Great. Check. We get critical wins. Check. But then I forgot the other big thing, which is how are you going to sell it and market it? Philips had no clue. They just wanted to sell TVs.
So they were counting on the Wintel marketing prowess to sort of tail.
They didn't know what they were
to draft on.
They just didn't know what they were doing. Okay. They're just like, oh, like retailers didn't even know where to put these things. They're, oh, it's a calculator, right? Like they just didn't even know because it was so still so new.
But wasn't Microsoft out pushing those things? Wasn't this a big Microsoft push?
It was a big Microsoft push, but the retailers didn't understand because they saw it as a computer product. There were no computer stores anymore. Computerland, everybody. So everybody didn't know what it was, right? Because HP had their little like HP computer. Yep. So that was where it was, but no one knew how to sell it. It was just a whole new category. There weren't that many new categories being created in retail,
yeah,
right, back then. Now there are, but back then they didn't know how to adapt.
So how long before you decided you had to leave?
So I was there, well, I was there a total of 4 years, but I left that group after 3 years, and then I went to become a venture capitalist at Philips on the digital trends, because we were investing in TiVo, so I learned about the investing environment and startups and all those other things.
That. Okay, but then you decided to strike out on your own.
So I'm watching everybody, all these other people making companies, and I'm watching them get funded, and I'm like, shit, I can do that, right? And that's what happened.
It was
So then I left Philips and I go, I'm going to write a business plan and then start to create a next generation company. And it was all about, we were trying to build the Dell of consumer electronics. So what was consumer, because I learned that in retail, like there was the analog to digital transition. HDTV was coming. There was no LCD screens yet, but there was DVDs were there. And we were like, wait a second. People have to, if they want to put a home theater together, they have to pick the right screen, the right speakers, the right, you know, amps and right things, and they need all the right cables. And it was really confusing and hard. You had to be a real geek to put together a home theater. So I was like, well, you saw what Dell did with PCs to make it easy. So we're going to make the Dell of consumer electronics, and we're going to make a slim box that was going to be, you put your CDs in, it would rip the CDs and then put them on a hard drive. So Samsung was going to supply the other components. We were going to make an online store where you could select different things, and we were going to have one thing that differentiated, which was this hard drive rack mount MP3 player.
But before it happens, you get a call.
Not before it happens.
Oh, it was out? You got it into the market?
No. So before we shipped it, yes.
Yeah.
But we had built it.
Yeah.
And then 2000 happened, right? The internet blew up. Hardware companies? They weren't funding even software companies in 2000, right? It was like, geez, everyone's holding on for dear life, right? Because everyone's bleeding cash. Yeah. Hardware companies, they don't want anything to do with it,
yeah.
Right? And they're like, Tony, you're crazy. Go software. What's this? Yeah. And so then I couldn't get any more money. And so I get a call from Apple saying, would you consult for us? We need a project done. And I was like, shit, this is a way to get money for the startup. So I'll go and moonlight on that to fund it. And that turned out ultimately to be the iPod.
That became the iPod, yeah. And but before I go all the way forward, how come you didn't, a bunch of GM people, General Magic people, went with Steve Perlman to
WebTV.
WebTV, did you ever think about going in that direction?
They did WebTV after I started Philips.
I see, so you're too early.
I was already into my next thing.
Okay, so talk a little, let me ask you about the dial. On the iPod.
The click wheel.
Yeah. Was that part of your original design?
Well, you can see it here.
Yeah.
So this was the original, this is the picture of the original styrofoam model that I made that was weighted in everything that Steve picked up, and that was the pitch.
So you had how quickly did you do that?
I did that all in 6 weeks.
6 weeks.
6 to 7 weeks. Everything I put, because I had to get back to the startup, my startup. So it was like, how fast can I make this to get my money so I can get back to work?
And he liked it. I mean, it wasn't one of those.
Oh, it was a green lighted. Now it was green lighted, maybe not to ship, but it was green lighted to go to the next phase.
Yeah.
As quickly as possible to see how real this styrofoam thing was. Because
yeah.
I had literally made all the components inside. I made all the Lego blocks that were inside this, and you could see how they were pieced together. So I had that along with some other models, the ones that were thrown out because they weren't the right design.
And where did that capacitive dial idea come from?
Well, it wasn't capacitive. It was a mechanical wheel first.
Was it really? I've forgotten that. Okay.
It was mechanical first, and then because we had so many failures in the field and stuff, it went to a capacitive wheel. So where did it come from? Truth be told, now it's so many years later. So this is what Phil Schiller did, because he was such a fan of Bang & Olufsen. It was a Bayo phone, blah, blah, 3000 or something. And it had a wheel on it, just one wheel to select names from a list. And that was the thing. He's like, so I had this thing, and I was like, main control input, and I thought it was just going to be a up, down, left, right. And then he goes, and then, you know, we do all this, and Steve's like, I love it, we're going to do this thing and everything. And then, but we gotta talk about one more thing. And I wasn't an employee at the time, right? I was just a contractor. And then Phil turns to Steve and says, can we bring out this thing? And Steve goes, yeah, you can show him. So Phil runs into Steve's office, grabs the phone, and brings it back, the Bayocom, or Bayophone, whatever it was, and he goes, this. And they go, can you put that on there? I went, oh, I know how that works. Sure, I can put that on there, no problem. And they go, sold, let's go. And I go, wait a second, I got a startup. I don't know if I'm joining you. I got other things. You know, you guys can go do this thing. Because remember, Apple wasn't an $800 billion valuation company it is today.
Yeah, yeah.
It was break even,
and still
$500 million in debt, $150 million in the bank. You're like less than 1% market share in the US only. You're like, are you going to go join this thing? Right?
So then there was that moment in this room, which has been widely chronicled, where they put you on the spot.
Was afterwards.
But that was where you made your, was that literally where you made your decision?
Yes. That was literally when I made my decision.
So who was it? It was Rubenstein who basically sort
Well, we gotta tell the story, right? Okay. We can't just you gotta okay. You might have tell heard the story, but they gotta tell the whole story. So I was really not sold to go to this computer company that wasn't doing so well. my startup was doing so well, but you know, why do I always gonna commit to that? And so I said, and we had negotiated for like 4 weeks now, and John and Steve and everyone's getting pissed at me because I'm like, no, this isn't right yet. I said, this is not what I want. And so they started to get closer to what I want, but not enough. But I go, look, I want to start meeting all the people who I would be working with. So Phil Schiller, da 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 da. So I want to meet these people. So they set up a day where I went and met with all kinds of different people around the company for a half an hour to get to know who I'd be working with. And the last person was Steve, right, to sit down and do a one-on-one. So then I'm with Steve. So it's going well, and then Steve's like, and I'm like, Steve, look, I learned from Phillips, you know, if we have enough time and money, we can make anything. But how are you going to sell it? Like, Sony's number one in every single audio category. How are you going to sell this thing? Like, I'm not going to waste all my time. And he's like, look, if you can make this, I'm going to put every dollar of Apple marketing behind it. I'm going to stop marketing for the Mac for a little while, and we're going to put all of it behind it. And I'm like, okay. And I'm looking at my watch, and I'm running late because I'm supposed to go to another meeting where I'm going to unveil this project to Johnny Ive and all of these, Greg Joswick and all these other people. There was 35 people waiting. But I got Steve, so I'm going to keep going. So we're like getting this and so I'm late. I'm like 30 minutes late. I show up to the room. all these people look at me. They don't know who I am. They're like, who is this? And they all stare at me, and they're all mad because they're sitting there waiting. And John looks at me, and he goes, are you going to take the job now? And I look, and there's all these people I don't know anything about. And I'm like, huh? He's like, you need to sign on the bottom line right now on the job, or we're going to cancel this meeting, and it's over. And I was like, what? So I turn to the room, and they say, and I go, is this how you guys hire everybody at Apple? And it was a nervous laughter, and they don't know what the hell's going on either. And I look at John, and I can go, give me what I want, or I was like, I'll say yes, and I'll fix it later. So I just looked at him in a deep, like, and I went, okay, I'm in. Within a nanosecond after doing that and shaking his hand, I fell into complete shock. I was like, bah. And I sat down, and I couldn't give the presentation. All the slides and everything. And back then, we were on, like, transparencies. Like, transparencies on a freaking, like, and I was like, and so for 20 minutes, I couldn't put two and two together, so other people were helping. But I couldn't. And so, needless to say, that was how I got going.
How hard was it to unwind your how hard was it to get out of Fuse? Were there venture backers or what was, or?
It, because we were so close to the edge, it was not hard. Okay. And then I was able to pull a lot of people over because I couldn't hire from other people, other teams inside of Apple, because they were already strapped. I could take just a few people or a bunch of people from Fuse. That was the beginning of the team when we added other people around the edges.
So how much of iPod was a success, but how much of the real sort of the real success of iPod was the combination of iTunes and iPod?
The whole experience was designed so that you did all the difficult stuff on the computer where you had all the...
Right from the start?
From the start.
Really?
You did all your organization, all your playlist management, all your ripping. You did everything over there, and then you just transferred, and it was only a consumption experience over here. You only consumed. You did all your other stuff there.
Didn't iTunes come afterwards?
No, iTunes was first. iTunes was first.
Okay. No.
People were ripping CDs and then burning CDs. And then there was MP3 players, and then people were trying to get music onto them, and there was Diamond Rio and stuff. And the experience was so horrible, that's when they called me up and said, we think there's a better way.
So who coined the marketing phrase, 1,000 songs in your pocket?
You know, that is the best marketing tagline you've ever heard in the fewest words ever to communicate what it was. And that was the agency did.
Interesting.
The agency did, yeah, shy it.
So you got a huge success, but there's this, on the horizon, there's this.
It wasn't that much of a success the first 2 years.
2 years.
The first quarter went to all the Mac loyalists. And then after that, no one bought it because it only worked with a Mac. So how many?
Okay.
Right? It didn't work with PCs.
Okay.
And Steve hoped that people were going to buy Macs to buy iPods. I was like, Steve, how much does an iPod cost? He goes, $399. I go, no, $399 plus $2,000.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Yeah. And so then we finally, you know, the old Mossberg story, and then we shipped it on the PC.
But ultimately smartphones or whatever
feature phones.
They're a potential threat to your business.
They were existential threat.
Yeah.
So
is that what led directly to the iPhone?
Well, it led to the Motorola Rocker.
Oh yeah.
So you might remember the ill-fated Motorola Rocker, which was a disaster.
Yeah.
Steve hated it. He didn't even want to demo it on stage. It was so bad. And that was when we got absolute religion that we are going to build our own thing. And it was not going to be a phone with software. It was going to be a computer with a phone.
And two prototype sort of paths started, P1 and P2?
No. There was first the iPod phone.
But didn't that become P1?
No.
No.
There was the iPod phone. So imagine the iPod as a phone. And you would dial a number with that, right? Hi.
But you could never make that work. You could never.
It was just a rotary phone. It was like when, you know, Alexander Graham Bell, you know, like, like when I grew up. Like,
but everybody knew how to use it. All the old people knew how to use it.
Yeah. Well, I don't, you know, it wasn't quite a great experience. But we tried like 30, 40 different ways to make that thing a phone. And it didn't work. And then we built P1. And then we threw that away. And then we made P2.
And P1 had also the circular model?
No, P1 was actually a full, what you would consider an iPhone today.
But not multi-touch?
No, it had multi-touch. Okay. The thing is, it was in a iPod mini case. So if you see that iPod, the blue iPod, that was what I was designed. So it was rounded on the edges. Okay. You'd insert it through, and it was this thing. But because of the aluminum structure, we couldn't get any signal. Because you couldn't get any antennas to work, right? Yeah. So we built this whole thing, and then we became this like Frankenstein because we had to have all these big plastic caps on it. The design was horrible. Like we were all newbies at designing a, you know, kind of a cell phone plus computer. Yeah. So we threw it all away and said, okay, what would we have done differently? And like, okay, and then that's when we're like, let's make it easy, do a plastic back and da 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 to make the iPhone happen.
So one of the puzzling aspects of Isaacson's book on Jobs is he puts two stories forward to explain multi-touch. One story has Steve going to a dinner with Bill Gates, and let's see, there's a guy who sort of describes how you have a tablet of the future with a stylus.
So Lorene had a girlfriend had a husband. And they came over to dinner to Steve's house, because Steve would tell us the story all the time. And they came over. And this guy was annoying to Steve, okay? And he would always tell Steve, like, what they were doing in Microsoft, and, like, Pen Windows was it, and, like, da-da-da-da-da. And he was so annoyed by it, he's like, I'm going to show him how to goddamn do it right. I'm sick and tired of this guy. I'm sick and tired of hearing about Microsoft doing this thing. We're going to do it the right way, and it's going to have no stylus. Right? So that was the first thing where, like, stylus was not allowed. And I have a follow-on story to that one other day. But no stylus is allowed. You're going to do everything with your finger. Because you don't need, this is your stylus. And everything's got to fit within your fingertip.
But he didn't know about multi-touch. This was just a...
No, he didn't know about multi-touch yet.
Ultimately, you found a company that had multi-touch technology, and you grabbed them. And
yep, tiny them. Little company that had multi-touch, yeah. Capacitive multi-touch.
But there was a group within Apple who didn't buy in for a long time. They saw the BlackBerry experience and they liked the keyboard, without naming names.
That's right. Well, look, it was the hottest thing selling, right? This little company in Canada all of a sudden was, you know, had all the profit, you know, in the cell phone business, had the most valuable customers, had a service, you know, because they had the email service. Like, it was the thing to beat. Yeah. It was a phenomenon, right? So how could you go cut against the grain when people were like, it was called Crackberry for a reason.
Yeah.
Right?
So here you're designing a competitor. When did you become sure of the idea of multi-touch as being a workable? How long did it take you to believe?
It took about 5 months. Because, you know, you start with a ping pong size multi-touch display. It was literally a ping pong table that was a projector, projected a Mac, and all the chips and all that stuff were around it to make it work. So you had to figure out if you could make a small touchscreen. Then you had to figure out if you could make a keyboard, virtual keyboard, and then all the details to make the virtual keyboard actually work good enough to get things done. So you had this whole list of all these risks. And then we'd have to, like, every week march to get confident to then just say, we're jettisoning that and we're going to go this way. So all kinds of software mock-ups, software-only mock-ups, hardware mock-ups, making hardware starting to work, doing touchscreens that weren't multi-touch but single-touch just to get the experience. So it was all of this, all of these crazy prototype things because we didn't have that to make it. So you had to...
Well, you know, you're in a competitive industry. You're trying out a new technology. You spend 6 months on it. If it fails, if it doesn't work, you've wasted 6 months. Did you feel...
Well, no, we did the iPod phone and we threw it away too. So the clock was always ticking, but it was ticking to find the solution, not to just settle, right? Like, we had to ship something. That's what most companies do. Yeah. Oh, just ship whatever because we have to do that. No, we shipped the right thing. That's why it took three different versions to actually, for the one to ship, the right one to ship.
The other thing that's always puzzled me, I mean, there is, you know, you were competing against this Wintel world that traditionally had separated hardware and software and did them as separate things. And, you know, Apple's advantage was always the single unified experience. But inside, you had a design team, you had a hardware team, you had a software
ID team, we had antenna teams, we had all kinds of stuff, right?
So how did you make that work? I mean,
sheer will. Like, it just, we have to do this. And so everybody would be bonded together, like, we're going to go arm in arm and we're going to make this thing happen, right? And we would, different teams would try different ideas out, and we would, the ideas would compete to see which one would win. So it was not like, we all knew that this is what we wanted to build. It was just, how were we going to get there? And we had to evolve very quickly to find the right path,
yeah.
Right? And so it was just a lot of people working on a lot of things all in parallel. We were boiling the ocean. We had to build our own touchscreen manufacturing, right? We had to build the touchscreen. We had to build chips for that. We made custom chips for the phone. We made all new software stacks, new operating system, new apps, all new modalities of how to use the thing. So it was, every single thing was new. There was, you know, except maybe the DRAM. We didn't do DRAM and flash, but literally the power supplies, everything was new.
So you basically built the touchscreen was a company in itself?
The touchscreen was a company in itself.
Were you involved in that?
Yes. When Steve put the big thing in, you know, the big ping pong table in front, it's like, well, this is what we're going to put on this little device. It was a ping pong table. You think we can make this into, I'm like, well, walk me through, you know? I'm like, there was no unobtainium there. There was no like breaking laws of physics. It was just a lot of hard work. Now you could have a lot of risks and maybe it all fell over, but you could see the steps you needed to take to work out each of the risks.
Yeah.
And that's what we had to do. But you know, we did crazy stuff. Like 3 months before the iPhone shipped, we moved from plastic on the top to glass. If anyone understands anything about hardware engineering, 3 months before production, you're going to switch from plastic to glass and all the drop testing, and it's gonna, and you're like, you drop it, it's gonna, you know, shatter.
Plastic scratch, that's why you built.
Yeah, the plastic would scratch because you'd have keys in your, right, because we had it on the iPhone, or excuse me, the iPod, because
yeah.
It had plastic and it would scratch. So it's like, we gotta go glass. I'm like, holy sh! We were moving mountains.
Yeah.
Right, to get glass on it and redesign everything in 3 months after we had already showed it to the world.
So what's the bad day working for Steve Jobs like?
A bad day is either one where he assumed that you were covering something and you guys were seeing eye to eye on something. Like it happened on just before the iPod shipped. There was this big thing because he assumed it was going to be this way when we were designing it that way, and we never really talked about it. But there was a good reason why we did it that way. So it was usually kind of this mismatch of how it was going to, his expectation versus what was being delivered. Or we overlooked something. You know, we being the engineering team or the design team or something, and like, oh shit. We're going to have to tell him that, right? And then it was like, you know, it was, you know, it was a interesting discussion.
I also heard,
you know,
that
the phrase, I'm going to dress you down now, you know, was heard a few times.
Okay. I also heard that if you stood up and pushed back, that Steve would often come around. That if you were really committed to your ideas, that he would ultimately adopt your ideas and then they would become his ideas.
Okay, so first, there are fact-based decisions and there are opinion-based decisions. You could almost always win the fact-based decisions if you put in enough work and get enough data to present the facts. You could win those. Opinion-based decisions, good luck. Because there's one guy who held the opinion. But if you came with 5, 6, 7 people, he trusted their opinions. And we were all singing the same song, going, this has to be this way. Let me show you enough reasons from all the different angles. You could then get him to change. It wasn't easy, but you could do it.
Yeah.
But then he saw that we were all you know, we were aligned and we're like, this is the right thing, Steve. You know, listen, listen, listen. And he would definitely move. So it was not like, you know, but there were certain things like no stylus was like a big deal. Like, no, no. And like it was, or, and then at some point when the keyboard was working enough, I don't want to talk about it anymore.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
So you came to this, you know, with a decade of 10 years of sort of being in Silicon Valley without a big success. You're at General Magic, you're at Philips. Can you sort of name sort of, what did you learn from failure, and was that, did it serve you well at Apple?
Oh, absolutely. Well, okay. So first thing was, like I said, you know, scope the project. Don't have a four-year project. We did a four-year project at General Magic, right? We know what happens. The world changes a lot in 4 years. And today, really, it changes a lot. But scope it so you can deliver something so that the team, it doesn't become an Apollo mission or like a Bay Bridge project that takes two generations to get done. Do something that gets in a year or a little bit longer than that so you can keep the team together and motivated. So one was scoping it right and shipping. Great artists have to ship. Don't keep adding stuff. So that was the first thing. Then the next one was make sure you're solving a need that people are going to have in sometime real soon, right? I communicate. Then don't just have that and then make sure it's a great design, but then make sure you understand the sales and marketing of how you're gonna get it and the messaging for why people need it, and make sure you have it properly, because you can make all this stuff, but then if you wasted all your money and you have nothing left to sell it and you don't know how you're gonna sell it, well, shit, you can build anything, but can you sell it? So yeah, that was another lesson learned, right? So it was all of these kinds of failure upon failure upon failure upon failure. Like, then you kind of realize, oh, this is kind of the recipe for success now.
Yeah.
Right? And then Steve then took it to the next level, which was total experience. Marketing, packaging, all the accessories, all the, you know, just making sure you had this in this entire experience from the time they saw the first ad to the time it was unboxed, the time, you know, all those details.
Yeah.
So, you know, very, very interesting.
Let me put you on the spot. You know, from being around the Valley for a long time, one of the things I like to say is the visionaries are always wrong. And so you've lived through sort of what I think of as two big generations of computing. I mean, more than lived through them. You've created two generations of computing. One is personal computing. And the other is kind of the flip side, ubiquitous computing, where, you know, I don't know who said it, but, you know, computing disappears into everyday objects and they become magic. I mean, you built one. It was called Nest. You built three, actually. You know, the music player combined with computing, the phone combined with computing, and the thermostat combined with computing. So what's next? In terms of generational, can you see your way to something beyond ubiquitous computing, which is, or Internet of Things, where we are now? Is there, if you had to sort of say, what's the next big thing in Silicon Valley?
What's the next big thing in Silicon Valley? I think it's reapplying all this technology to other fields. You know, at some point, we've kind of given ourselves all these tools, but now it's reapplying these tools and really disrupting the other fields. Like a lot of times, if you talk, you know, just before, there wasn't a lot of computing in biology. You know, maybe there's spreadsheets and there was little trackers and communication, but truly doing computational biology. Okay, great, right? We're there. So it's taking all of these resources and then reapplying it to other fields. Like we're seeing it now with autonomous driving, right? Take all this stuff, put new sensors on it, and now we're enabling a whole new set of functionality that the world's ever seen. So I think it's about bringing these kinds of capabilities into these other realms and disrupting them and changing them. Yeah. Because we've gotten to a place where we have a ton of functionality, what we need on our person. Yeah. Now let's put all these things around us. And
so a last question. Let's say you show up now, 20 years after the fact, you're a kid, you show up here in the Valley. What would you tell someone similar to you who just walked in, you know, wet behind the ears in Silicon Valley today?
You are going to work very hard. You are going to have a ton of failure. Do not read the popular press that all of these startups all make it. You're going to work your butt off. It's going to take a decade or a decade and a half to actually, if you want to live this dream, be prepared that that's what it's going to take. Now, and make sure you ask for help for everybody around you, because that's what the Valley's all about, is that, you know, I'm only up here because of many people in this audience who helped me get here, right? And that, make sure you extend a hand when you're asked for help, and these people will extend a hand when you ask for help,
yeah.
Right? And that's the magic of Silicon Valley. It's that thing, and I hope we don't lose it. It seems like we're starting, it's getting diluted, because it's all about mine and backstabbing. Like, you know what it was like in the 80s here, in the 90s. Like, it was like we're all trying to make this new world together. And we would, and it was not about this company versus this. It was about the relationship you had with each of the people that you worked with. And when they went to the competition, because that's what they want to do, you still stayed friends. It wasn't like this, right? And, you know, my best friends, right? 25 years, we've been competing, we've been on the same team, we've had, but it's that human element that continues to move forward. And now the babies that were born at General Magic, I was like, I couldn't wait to have them be interns and come to my team and be on my team. Like, and we watched that cycle of mentorship happen, right? And I hope that in the next 20, 30 years, I'm going to be able to do what those people who helped me to give back to other, you know, 20-something, 30-something who have their dreams to help them with theirs, not just in Silicon Valley, but hopefully around the world. Because I think that's the way we continue to exist as a society. Because we're not just going to all be behind screens competing with each other, because that's not what this is about.
Well, thanks for this little window into this little bit of Silicon Valley history. Join me in giving Tony a hand.
Thank you, everybody.
That was Tony Fadell, iPod and iPhone co-creator and co-founder of Nest. Next time, you'll hear from Mary Lou Jepsen, a former Google X and Facebook Oculus executive who is now designing a wearable medical imaging device. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of CHM Live Radio. This podcast is produced by Lauren Miyamoto and me, Chanel Lauren. John Plute composed our intro music, and transitional music is provided by Lee Rosevier. You can learn more about our events and the museum at computerhistory.org.
This program was brought to you by the Computer History Museum.